Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Find out what truly creates and defines a psychopath from the leading expert who helped to create Killing Eve's Villanelle. Dr. Mark Freestone has worked on some of the most interesting, infamous, and disturbing cases of psychopathology in recent years. His expertise has led to a consultant role on several TV series, helping them accurately portray their fictional villains. Now he shares his phenomenal insight into the minds of some of the world's most violent real-life criminals. Angela the Remorseless, a rare female psychopath, casually confessed to murder on national television without a hint of regret. Danny, the borderline, switched from grandiosity to rage to despair within minutes and killed his defenseless friend without explanation. Tony, the con man, preferred charm, intimidation, and sexual abuse over physical violence and once tried to dupe someone into buying the Eiffel Tower. Jason, the liar, had a fantasy life that led to vicious murders around Europe and preyed on those who see the good in people. Case by fascinating case, get to know seven of the most dangerous minds that Dr. Freestone has encountered over the last 15 years. These are up-close accounts of some of the most psychopathic criminals and of what can happen if you fall victim to their supreme powers of manipulation. Exploring the many factors that make a psychopath, the complexities and contradictions of their emotions and behavior, as well as an examination of how the lives of psychopaths develop inside and outside the institutions that are supposed to contain them. Making a psychopath opens up a window into the world of those who operate in a void of human emotion and what can be done to control them. The book that we're featuring this evening is Making a Psychopath, My Journey into Seven Dangerous Minds, with my special guest, author Dr. Mark Freestone. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Dr. Mark Freestone.
My pleasure to be here, Dan.
Thank you so much. Our pleasure. Now, you start off the introduction in this book. You state that you're not a psychiatrist and you're not a forensic psychologist. So tell us about your training and also tell us about biopsychosocial understanding of mental illness and mental disorders, pardon me.
Yeah, of course, Dan. That's a good way to start out. So you sort of know where I'm coming from.
Right.
So I was a sociologist. I trained in sociology. And I think that maybe sociology, although it does include elements of psychology in its sort of training pathway, and certainly I did a lot of psychology as a young student. I think sociology tends to look for more group-based or social level, societal level explanations for behavior and for consequences of people's behavior. So my PhD was actually based on anti-globalization protest, which sounds a long way away from mental health and psychopathy. But what I was specifically looking at was how groups of people form around particular protest organizations. And I found that actually, curiously enough, although I was looking at anti-globalization protest, there was a big shift around 9/11, actually, which took place in the middle of my PhD study, away from that sort of anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movements into an anti-war movement. But what I found was quite interesting was it was the same people who were organizing protests, who were sort of, they become almost like professionalized protesters or professionalized protest organizers. And as I was reaching the end of the PhD, my supervisor said, well, the methodological approach that you use, the way that you come to understand and work with these groups of protesters would be really interesting in a secure hospital. Now, a secure hospital is not something that exists in quite that form in the United States.
Right.
They have these in Canada, but essentially they're hospitals that exist to house people who are already convicted criminals or who are or would be convicted criminals if they weren't found not guilty by reason of insanity, as we say
right.
in the UK. Or in other words, they're not culpable for their crime because they were suffering from a mental disorder at the time they committed it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these had been set up at a high security hospital just up the road from the university where I was working at Rampton Hospital in the UK, which is one of our three maximum security hospitals. And it was called the Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder Unit.
Wow.
And essentially the role of this was to try and treat psychopaths or people with a level of personality pathology. So difficulties in relating to other people, difficulties in understanding and dealing with emotion, equivalent to those of somebody who was a psychopath. This was a very bold move. Nobody else really tried this before. In the Netherlands, the Dutch have a system kind of analogous called the Terbeschikkingstelling system, but it doesn't explicitly work with psychopaths in quite the same way. So this was very innovative, very cutting edge, and sort of very exciting place to be. But as I rapidly discovered, it's not as simple as that to suddenly overturn 50 years of failed attempts to treat psychopathy, and things tended to go a little bit badly wrong in those units. But what I think you touched on with your question about the biopsychosocial approach is that a lot of the thinking around mental disorder in the UK for a long time, I think it's probably true of the US and Canada as well, is based around a biomedical model. So this is the idea that mental disorders are necessarily biological illnesses that are based in some kind of biological problem. It could be something about the neurological wiring. It could be a problem that's based in a sort of a genetic coding that leads you to lack the emotions that other people would have. And the biopsychosocial model just sort of critiques that biomedical understanding and says, well, what about the societies that people grow up in? What about the influence of childhood? What about the influence of attachment in the way that people develop? And trying to sort of recast mental disorders like psychopathy and personality disorder as problems that are not just medical. They involve the input from a lot of other kind of professional disciplines, social work, probation officers, prison officers, potentially nurses, and maybe even wacky sociologists like me to try and understand them and cast them in a way that says these are problems that can't just be solved by medicine. And that's particularly true of psychopathy, of course, because we don't have a drug to treat psychopathy.
Right.
We don't even have drugs to treat the symptoms. We have to approach it in a biopsychosocial way in order to manage people with a diagnosis of psychopathy.
You talk about the masks of psychopathology or psychopathy, pardon me. And you also have, you talk about the gold standard of research being Hervey Cleckley from 1941, The Mask of Sanity. And then you say later with Robert Hare, the Psychopathic Checklist, and then with his second edition of the Psychopathic Checklist. Tell us just briefly about the effect that it has on psychopathic research or research about psychopathy, and then your criticism with the second edition of Robert Hare's Psychopathic Checklist.
Yeah, of course. So I think I talk about the idea of masks of psychopathy in the book, and that comes from Herb Cleckley's work on what he called the mask of sanity, the idea that psychopaths put on a mask of appearing to be normal. To anyone who meets a psychopath for 5 minutes wouldn't know they'd met a psychopath. In fact, quite the opposite. They might have thought, what a charming
right.
and sort of urbane, interesting individual. So this is what Cleckley means. Psychopaths have the ability to pass themselves off quite competently as a normal, adjusted, functioning, empathic human being, over short spaces of time. So that's the idea of the sort of the mask that, that psychopaths wear. And beneath that mask is a sort of a seething mass of very confused morality and a real absence of a connection to other human beings, which looks like insanity in many ways, because it's impossible for us without being psychopaths, I think, to understand the absence of a moral code or moral compass that psychopaths have. And I think that's one of the reasons why psychopaths in fiction are so compelling, because it's really, really difficult to think, what would my world be like if I simply didn't care about other people?
Mm-hmm.
And then Bob Hare, the Canadian forensic psychologist, sort of realizes her Kleckley's vision into a number of testable traits that psychopaths have. There's 20 traits in the psychopathy checklist, and it very quickly becomes, particularly the PCL, the second edition that you mentioned, the psychopathy checklist revised that was published in 98, that quickly becomes sort of the only accepted way of identifying and clinically assessing for psychopathy in just about any developed country. It's been translated into, I think, 18 languages, and there's a youth version as well, and a screening tool that's sometimes used. So many, many different versions, many, many different languages, to the exclusion of anything else. And I think that the issue that I have is that nothing that's, what is it now, 24 years old, is ever going to represent the state of the art in research. It just isn't. And I think, just to take an example, something that Kleckley noticed was that psychopaths tend to have much, much lower thresholds of anxiety than people who weren't psychopaths in a usual way. And Bob Hare's always been very resistant to including anxiety in any shape or form in the psychopathy checklist. But actually, the latest research suggests that people's levels of anxiety, of what we call, I guess, just sort of general dissatisfaction with the world, are a pretty good way of distinguishing certainly primary psychopaths from secondary psychopaths, which we might go into later, but would be a really good trait to add. But Bob Hare isn't interested, I think, in changing it now, because it's adopted by most of our legal systems and we use it in the courts very, very regularly. So why change it? But I'm not sure that that's the best way of thinking about it. And there's been a lot of alternative assessments put forward. There was a sort of a cross-Atlantic one called the Comprehensive Assessment of Psychopathic Personality, that was proposed by Stephen Hart in Canada and Caroline Logan and David Cook in the UK, which looked at psychopathy without the forensic element. So if you take away the antisocial features of the psychopathy checklist, you're left with an assessment that could accurately predict psychopathy in people who weren't criminals. Whereas a weakness of the psychopathy checklist, in my opinion, is that it contains a very large number of items that relate simply to antisocial or outright offending behavior. So this wonderfully fascinating idea of a sort of successful or non-criminal psychopath is not something we can adequately assess for using the PCLR. So lots of other reasons that I won't go into now, but I think it's maybe time for us to rethink the way that we measure psychopathy.
In that vein, you give an example in the book of James Fallon. Tell us about this extraordinary example.
Yeah, so a professor of neuropsychology at Stanford University, James Fallon, conducts a very interesting experiment to look at differential emotional responses within the brain, so neuropsychological responses to disturbing stimuli. And he does this using an approach called contrast tomography, so a sort of scan of the activation of electrical impulses in the brain. And he recruits two groups of people. He recruits people who have either been pre-screened as having psychopathy or are currently offenders on parole. And then he recruits a control group of just people on the street or his grad students. And he realizes that he's not been putting enough effort into recruiting the control group. And I can totally relate to this, because it's so time consuming, difficult to recruit offenders and psychopaths into any study. There's a lot of ethical loopholes you have to go through. A lot of people don't understand it. So you put a lot of effort into that. And then it's like, well, where's your control group? And oh God, I've got to find some people to come do my research study.
Yeah.
So he scans himself just to sort of fill in. And then he's looking through the slides, and he's pretty much, you know, it's actually a really interesting and influential study. He notices that the activation of the amygdala, which is a lobe in the middle of the brain, just above the limbic system, so just above where the brain stem meets the gray matter of the brain itself, is much, much, much lower in one of his controls. And he thinks, oh, that's odd. This looks like a psychopath. What am I going to do with this one? So he says, well, I better find out who it is so I can call them and tell them they're a psychopath. And he cross-matches it to his master key list of participants and realizes this is his own brain scan.
Wow.
And he describes this beautifully in his TED talk and his book. He says, I just sort of, you know, I had this eureka moment where all of these difficulties and this lack of understanding I faced when dealing with other people in my life suddenly made sense. It's not because I was going about it wrong or there was anything wrong with them. It was something about the way that I am that made it very difficult for me to relate to other people. And this is a successful man with a a very high profile career at an Ivy League university in the USA with a family. And this is something else that's very odd for a psychopath. They tend to have marital type relationships so they can become very intimate with people, but only over a short space of time. After about sort of 6 to 12 months, they tend to break up with their partners, usually due to infidelity or simply boredom on the part of the psychopath, and move on. And Jim has, you know, three kids, successful family life. And he sort of, you know, he thinks to back all the times where he's had people over to entertain him for dinner. And he just sits at the table and thinks, who are these people around eating my food in my house? Just get lost off you. And he thinks, that's the psychopath in me talking. But at the same time, it doesn't inhibit him from having a fulfilling family life.
Right, right. In this book, you describe composites of people that you've dealt with in the 15 years and beyond. And some of them are ones that you personally dealt with and others publicly visible ones. So let's start with one of the examples that you have is Paul the Hitman and what this illustrates.
Yeah, Paul was actually probably the most directly scary of all the psychopaths. I think, you know, there are a lot of other people in the book who aren't necessarily, I think looking into their history, they might have very scary crimes or they might be difficult to deal with, which I'm sure we'll touch on later. But I think Paul just interpersonally had an ability to command a room of people. And the context is important here because this is in the context of a prison where prisoners have virtually no power at all. They're completely beholden to the staff, the prison officers and the governors, and to an extent, psychologists and people like me who sort of work in clinical roles. And yet, virtually every meeting I went to in the prison, he was able to sort of control the room. And you always thought, well, who among the prisoners does he have something on that he can basically recruit them to his cause and get them to vote his way on any issue that may come up? And his offending history was, you know, he just sort of enforced nasty debts for drug dealers. So sure, if you've ever seen the British crime film Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, but there's a hitman there played by Vinnie Jones, who's actually known in British culture as a bit of a scary character. He was a footballer, but he was known for sort of violent incidents on the pitch.
Right.
So he was sort of the kind of enforcer who'd go around, break people's kneecaps, tie them up and torture them, or in some cases, kill them. But Paul was such an effective psychopath that rather than having to kill people directly, he would just get other people to do it, people who owed him money or people who he had under his thrall. And you could just sort of sitting in a room with him and having him hold court and, you know, sort of manipulate people into answering questions, you had a real sense of like, if this man asked you to do something in the community, what would you feel your options were to say no? And this isn't sort of thinking about, is he going to be violent? This is just his sort of personal gravitas, his sort of feeling that the way he worded his sentences and the way he spoke and the way he'd look at you when he was sort of suggesting that you do something kindly for him, which he did quite a lot to me, I think, because I was new, really carried a lot of weight. And it was difficult to sort of think how you could get out of doing things for him. But over the course of working with him, it transpired, you know, he'd actually embedded himself more sinisterly into the culture of the prison, that there were a lot of people doing favors for him, including some of the staff. And it actually caused quite a major scandal, which I detail in the book.
Yes. You talk about that there was a woman named Louise running the orientation group. And so to, again, as you have alluded to, that power extended into her compromising her job, her career, her life, for the, I guess, the favor of this Paul, the hitman.
Yes. Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff about psychopathy that we probably know, but haven't actually written up and published because it's clinical material. But we have this idea of something called a boundary violation, where when you're working with people with severe personality disorder or particularly psychopathy, because one of the constituent parts of the psychopathy checklist is manipulation. So the ability to con and manipulate people into getting your own way. And it's actually, there's a constant pressure to give way to people like Paul's, you know, attempts to sort of manipulate you, to control you, to get you to do what they ask. And I think in this case, Louise, the prison officer, had fallen into a sort of a state where she was able to actually enter into an intimate sexual relationship with Paul on the wing, which is absolutely taboo in every single sense. And I think, you know, if you think about this just interpersonally, you can easily think, well, you know, that could happen. He could sort of corner you in a room and then make a sort of inappropriate proposal, and, you know, something could happen, but then you'd probably go and report it. But what seemed to have happened in this particular case was that there were quite a few staff who were aware that this was going on and must have sort of had that, you know, what we call a false consensus. that everybody thought this was okay because, you know, it was only Paul and he's very charming, good looking, and, you know, Louise must know what she's doing or something like that. And that the worst part of this is that I was away from the prison to visit another hospital at the time. And I missed sort of the playing out of this. But eventually, the reason that the affair is discovered is not because somebody sees them, you know, having an intimate moment somewhere in the prison, but rather that Louise tries to challenge some other officers for bad behavior elsewhere in the wing, and that the officers threatened to reveal her affair with the prisoner, which they were already aware of. So a large proportion of the staff in the wing already knew about this affair, and it only came to light when she challenged them. And another officer who wasn't aware of it, walking past, heard what was going on, reported it to a governor. So it just shows you how deeply the sort of the roots of the psychopath's manipulative power can extend into a structure like a prison, however tight and tightly controlled. And this is what we call a category A prison in the UK. It was, you couldn't go anywhere without having helicopter wire above your head in case somebody tried to airlift a high-risk prisoner out. So it was one of the most secure places in the country and actually quite a well-respected jail as well. So with a good reputation for security, but nevertheless, this happened. And my contention is it wouldn't have happened if Paul hadn't have been such an effective psychopath.
Let's talk about Danny, the borderline, because you say that you learned so much from all of these cases, but you learned much more from this case. Tell us about this borderline, Danny the borderline.
Yeah, I mean, in order to be admitted into, this is another patient who's part of the Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder program. Now, in order to be admitted into this program, you had to be a psychopath, or you had to have, as I said, personality pathology equivalent to that of a psychopath. So that would mean very severe personality disorder features from the antisocial and borderline categories. So Danny had a PCLR score that would have made him a psychopath. But when I say I learned more from him than anyone else, I don't know if I necessarily learned a great deal about psychopathy, because I was really confused by the idea that this man was a psychopath. I think I just learned more about working with people with very disordered personalities and about myself as well, actually, because I think that plays a major part of it. Whenever you work with people with severe personality disorders, you start to think about what is my emotional makeup? What is it that makes me function with other people in a way that these people, these men and women can't? You know, what is it that makes us people with functional personalities as opposed to dysfunctional ones? And they also have and I think this is where Danny is really an interesting case. It's the ability to get under your skin, to say things or to do things that pull you in two directions at once. And one of those directions is to sort of think, oh, you know, you need help. You're a person who's suffering and you need my help and care. And at the same time, do something that's utterly revolting in many ways. And that could be violence towards other people. It could be violence towards themselves. And I think Danny had been violent to other people in his past, certainly, and he had a very unpleasant index offense of stabbing somebody who trusted him in the back. He's the main reason that it was so difficult to work with him was that his force of aggression was directed entirely at himself. So he used to just do the most awful acts of self-harm to himself that way exceed anything I'd ever seen in any prison or hospital before or after. And I've been around.
Yeah.
So, I detail it a little bit more in the book. I don't know if it's something that we want to go into too much detail, but I think what you learn from that is how to sort of sort out genuine concern from a sort of feeling of, I guess, a sort of natural response to care, and to provide your care in a way that never colludes with the person's, their disorder, if you like. So if somebody has a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, for example, part of their issue is that they are constantly looking for ways to find an identity that makes sense to them. And I think with Danny, what he was looking for was some sort of core part of his being, probably a spiritual one, that made sense to him. And what he would often do is try to associate with people who had a spiritual background. So there was a chaplain in the hospital who he was very attached to. And we became a little bit worried because, of course, his index offense was against somebody from the clergy as well. And that relationship had to be monitored very carefully. But then halfway through that, he decided he wanted to affiliate with Wicca, which is a much more pagan religion in the UK. And the chaplain was trying to support him with that. But this constant flitting between spiritual identities, between sexual identities, between gender identities was something that really defined Danny in quite I think the word I'm looking for is like vertiginous, like the shifting was so quick and so unexplained that it made you feel a little bit of vertigo. Like you're like, well, you were a Christian yesterday and you're a Wiccan today. Now, right. How does that work? Because those things are opposed in my mind. And what it does is that sort of throws your logical train of thought and it throws your natural human responses like empathy into a sort of spiral where you're not sure whether you are resentful of this person for deceiving you or whether you feel more empathy for them because they clearly need more help than you thought, or whether you should just reject them because this is so much to take in and absorb at once that it's just impossible and you should give up now. And that huge combination of emotions, which can shift very quickly within the course of about a week, is a lot to deal with. And I think that's why I say I learned the most from that case, simply because it taught me a great deal about trying to manage my expectations and my own emotional states whenever I go into work with people in these kind of settings and with this diagnosis.
You say in the book that it's a paper thin line between insanity and psychopathy. So let's use this as an opportunity, Mark, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. My wife, Lisa, and I have been doing some renovating during the winter months, and so it's time to do some serious spring cleaning. And you know, it's just as important to take care of your mental space. Over the years, negative thoughts and emotions can build up. That's why it's important to talk to someone who is trained to help you declutter your mental space. I believe in therapy and it's been very beneficial to me. Talkspace's approach is unique with therapists available anytime because when you're overwhelmed, it's normal putting off getting help. Finding a therapist, scheduling appointments, and traveling to an office can be daunting. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need from a licensed therapist anytime you need help. Talkspace takes the stress out of your first step with a more flexible, convenient, and affordable way to get high-quality care. With 24/7 text, audio, and video messaging, Talkspace lets you speak to a licensed therapist without needing an appointment. They have thousands of therapists across dozens of specialties. Once you match with your therapist, you can message them anytime, anywhere. If thoughts and emotions are piling up, a fresh perspective can help you feel better. Match with your dedicated therapist today at Talkspace.com and use promo code TRUEMURDER during signup to get $100 off your first month. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com, promo code TRUEMURDER. Now, Mark, we were talking about the thin line between insanity and psychopathy, and we were going to have another example, ironically, of that with one of the book chapters you call Angela the Remorseless. Okay, let's talk about Angela the Remorseless.
Yeah, so this actually comes from my work with Phoebe Waller-Bridge on Killing Eve, which was the BBC America TV program that I think it's just wrapped in the UK and it probably has in the US. So the series finale was last Tuesday. And I'd been asked by the production team to give some insight into how to write a psychopath. And obviously I have a lot of experience of working with male psychopaths, but not a great deal of working with women, for reasons that I actually describe a bit in the book. But the closest I sort of come to that work is we had a sister prison, a sister jail next to us in the jail I was working in at the time. And they were a female prison. They had female prisons only. They also had a smaller DSPD wing for women. It was actually intended to be for 40 women, but they only managed to find 12 women to fill it because there simply weren't that many diagnosable psychopaths in the UK female prison population, which was interesting in itself, I think. But one of the particular cases was causing them a lot of managerial problems because this is somebody who had a lot of experience of mental disorder. They were a practicing mental health professional and they'd become, I think, they develop what we call morbid jealousy, which is where jealousy becomes so powerful and so overpowering that it takes over sort of your emotional response and all of your energy becomes directed in this one sort of jealous fascination, right, with their, I think, ex-partner who'd set up with another partner. And their crime was actually against a bystander who got in the middle of this and they killed the bystander by accident, thinking they were going to shoot the new partner. And they needed some help from us in terms of how to accommodate somebody who had a very intimate knowledge of the mental health techniques they were using and also the structure of mental health services within prison, things like that. But when the producers of Killing Eve were developing the character, they'd actually found this case of Angela Simpson, who was a woman who was a resident of the southern United States who'd she committed a really, and it's one of those really sort of stomach-churning crimes where they targeted somebody quite vulnerable and they manipulated them in a very psychopathic way into a situation where they were even more vulnerable. So what Angela Simpson done, she targeted somebody she actually knew socially a little bit and knew that this person was attracted to her. So they'd invited him into to sort of spend an evening of Netflix and chill, if I can put it that way,
right,
for want of a better expression. And then during the course of that evening, confronted them with some allegations that it seems were entirely fabricated about being a snitch for the police force. I think what had happened was the victim had actually said, whilst they were in prison some years before, to somebody else that they'd informed on another offender at some point. And this was ancient history, and somehow it had come through the chain up to Angela. So when she got this man, who was actually quite disabled, he could walk, but he mostly used a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't really able to fight back, but she tied him to his chair and tortured him over the course of almost a 12-hour period. Eventually sort of driving nails into his skull, another sort of really just unnecessarily gratuitous things to do to another person, all in the sort of the vein of being a vigilante to sort of exterminate snitches and paedophiles from the world, which there was really no supporting evidence for. I mean, it's almost like she could have picked anyone and found a reason to torture them horribly. And at that was all pretty spectacularly dreadful. But what was so interesting was that at the end of this process, she goes to court, she's tried, and she's found guilty and sent to prison in the United States for, I think, a life sentence without parole. And then gives a number of interviews about it where she absolutely, I mean, when I talk about sort of the characteristics of the psychopathy checklist, if I could get somebody on camera acting out those characteristics, it would be actually not a man, but Angela Simpson, because she's so remorseless. I think there's at one point the interviewer says something like, well, you know, this was a terrible thing to do. Would you ever consider doing something again? And she says, absolutely. You know, why not?
Yeah.
Fewer snitches in the world. That's great.
Yeah.
As if this sort of, the crime has had no impact and she's made no attempt to establish empathy or remorse or what she's done at all. And it's actually so that there's a lot of this on YouTube, actually. Everyone's welcome to look it up. It's really fascinating to watch, if a little bit difficult at times. She actually uses this to kind of control and manipulate the interviewer, to sort of wrong foot the interviewer at times and make them think that maybe they're asking the wrong thing, or maybe that they haven't really properly understood the person that they're talking to, just to sort of intimidate, control, manipulate, all the sort of classic psychopathic things. And I think what's most interesting about this is that typically researchers always assumed that female psychopaths would be quite different to men. And when I was talking to the Killing Eve writing team, one of the things was, well, how do they differ? And one of the sort of central assumptions is that female psychopaths, often in fiction and from the limited number of case studies that we have, tend to use other people to do the dirty work, do the violence. So they're very good at emotional manipulation and emotional aggression, but not so much at the physical stuff. Whereas with Angela Simpson, this is sort of turned on its head. She is, to all intents and purposes, a very high-scoring male psychopath in the absolute classic sense of the term. And I think that was very influential with Villanelle, because we felt it gave us license to present a character who was female and glamorous and attractive, but was also able to portray very, very male psychopathic characteristics, which is just really interesting case that sort of, I think, took us all a little bit off guard, and yet illustrates that psychopathy isn't always a variant, or certainly is a personality type. It doesn't really vary that much between men and women.
Right.
Often the sort of the real interpersonal and emotional characteristics of psychopathy are constant across both men and women.
Let's talk about some of the things you say about adverse childhood experiences. And of course, you have to look at the background. And you did touch on when a child's identity is fractured. So talk about a little bit about how important the childhood background environment is and the role genetics plays in this as well.
Yeah, I should be balanced in my account here. There is a good basis for the genetic heritability of what we call callous and unemotional traits.
Right.
This was done by my colleague Gethie Biding at University College London. And she studied people children aged 7 and 9. And she looked at what I call callous unemotional traits, which basically refers to very early indicators of what might be psychopathic behavior. Now, it's really important to say that these aren't traits that will necessarily mean that these children will become psychopaths.
Right.
But they sound like you know, the adult definition. So cruelty to animals, cruelty to other children, lying, stealing, a lack of remorse for bad things that you've done, telling lies repeatedly to other people, things like that. So much more serious than just being a little bit uncontrolled or difficult. The heritability of that is pretty good. If you look at twin studies, you find that there's around about a 70% heritability of these callous unemotional traits in children, even at quite a young age. So there's clearly a genetic component to the sort of precursors of psychopathy. But I think with these twin studies, you know, it's never 100%, which seems weird if we're saying there's a genetic causal mechanism at play here, right? There should be 100% or 99% with a little bit of gray area.
Right.
So clearly there's something more going on. And I think that my experience certainly is that nobody I've worked with in prison or in hospital who's been diagnosable as a psychopath has had what I would call anyway an easy ride through their childhood. They've often been adopted, they've been abused, neglected, and even the people from reasonably middle-class backgrounds, like Tony in the book, for example, there's been something very odd going on. And I think in the United States, you have, I think it's Ed Gein, who's a very charming, very charming guy, apparently normal family background. But within this is this terribly controlling, almost demonic figure in his background. And it makes you think of Tony has this father and this grandfather who have a history of manipulating other people. It's their calling, basically. They are con men and that is what they do. And they hand this down in a sort of an authoritarian, paternalistic way to each other and then eventually to Tony. So he becomes a con man as well, because what is the family calling? You know, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, right.
So there's always something dark in their backgrounds. I don't think I've ever found or ever encountered a psychopath with an entirely normal family upbringing. And it sort of led me to think a little bit more about the difference between, and this is, Cleckley actually comments on this, and this is the basis of the original distinction between a psychopath, who was somebody who was characterologically morally insane, so somebody who just from birth was going to be manipulative and lack empathy, and what was called a sociopath. And that's not a term we really use anymore, but the idea of a sociopath was somebody who society had made morally insane. So they become antisocial through neglect, abuse, bad luck, you know, repeated social failure, things like that. And I think it's more complicated than that, because I think that sociopaths actually can be functionally identical to psychopaths in many ways. They can have that sort of...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Callous unemotionality. They can be manipulative. They can be liars. But the cause of it is different, because these are people whose sort of psychopathic presentation comes from neglect and abuse and sort of trying to just find a way to survive in a very adverse environment. Whereas the sort of more primary psychopaths, the characterological psychopaths, are inheriting something that's been passed down. But I think the differentiation that's important here is that the secondary psychopaths are, it's a defense basically against a nasty situation that they've acquired in childhood and can't let go of, because it's so difficult to drop your guard, if you like, to start feeling emotions when you know that you've been abused, you know that you've abused other people, and now your life is basically about violence. It's so difficult to let go of that. So it functionally looks the same as primary psychopathy, but I also think there's a little bit more hope for people who've acquired these sort of psychopathic characteristics, as I try to draw out in the final chapter of the book on Eddie.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's talk about, as you alluded to, Eddie, the Redeemed, as you title it.
So Eddie was somebody I've only met a few times very briefly when I was working in one of the lower security hospitals. And he was somebody who was reaching the end of his, if you like, criminal journey. So he been convicted and sent to prison many times. He'd been to mental hospital twice as well. And yet somehow in his last sentence, he'd found something that essentially offered him a chance at redemption. And in this case, it was a very experienced psychoanalyst, not me, but my supervisor, Dr. C, who was, somebody who had decades of experience as an analyst, but also a real, you know, a sort of anti-psychopathic empathy for people, regardless of how unpleasant or how sadistic or how manipulative or how aggressive they may appear. She was always able to find something within people that was worth holding on to, worth sort of treasuring and trying to encourage.
Okay.
And I think with Eddie, what she'd identified was somebody who had, exactly as actually I was just explaining, developed this kind of psychopathic defense. So his defense against the terrible experiences he'd had of being abused by his stepfather, of growing up in a childhood in East London, which it's a different world nowadays because I actually live in East London.
Okay.
But back in the sort of 1950s and 60s, just after the Second World War, a lot of the older industries in East London had left, particularly around the docks. So the shipping and fishing industries were really dying out. And it became a very poor and a very aggressive, violent place to be. And this is where the sort of classic, the classic idea of the London gangster comes in, the Cray twins, the sort of the older Guy Ritchie movies. It was a very poor and a very, very crime-ridden area.
Right.
And this was the area that Eddie grew up in. And I think that the combination of sort of the abuse in the family and particularly the really terrible abuse against his mother, who he thinks was raped at least twice by his stepfather, led him to develop a sort of very calloused, very psychopathic type personality. And that then drew him into behaving in a very psychopathic way. I mean, he's, in a way, he's very, very unlucky. And he, you know, that he, one of his first offenses, he actually kills somebody in what looks like, and I know, look, I've worked in forensics for 22 years now. I know that this sounds unlikely, but somebody actually falls on him while he's holding a knife in self-defense. And there are witness statements supporting this. You know, it's not a, and he was convicted of
manslaughter,
homicide, but with it. So what you call murder two or murder three in the USA, there's no intent to kill, it's simply a sort of a bad accident. And so he goes to prison, and then in prison, I think he's given some space to think about his life for the first time, and it simply becomes too much for him. And he starts to have really terrifying hallucinations about sort of things growing in his skin, sort of classical symptoms of actually psychosis, so schizophrenia, not psychopathy, rather than seeking help, which he doesn't feel able to do because he thinks if he seeks help, then he'll be exploited again. He becomes aggressive and difficult. And realizes that actually being aggressive in prison, certainly in the 1970s and 80s, gets him a better response and more is more effective for him than trying to sort of try to understand his problems and seeking help for them. So he goes through prison many, many times. And he's often sectioned and often, you know, his mental health problems are addressed in various ways by drugs and other things, but never really resolved. And I think he's released for one final time, and he's a very charming guy, Eddie, really, really, or he was. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago now, which was very sad because we had hoped to celebrate the book launch together and we never quite got to do that because of COVID. But he's released in prison for, I think, the third time, and then he commits another offense. He assaults a woman in a very sort of kind of pathetic way by disagreeing with something she's saying. He throws a bucket of water over her.
Yeah.
She calls the police, which she was completely in her, she was completely correct to do. Mm-hmm. And I think something inside him sort of wilts a bit and says, yeah, I just realized I didn't want to fight it anymore. So he hands himself into the police very, very calmly, and he serves his time. And then at the end of that, he decides to go into treatment. He goes into a treatment unit for men with personality disorder, meets Dr. C. And I think she sees, or she rather helps him to lay out this choice, is that you can either go through the rest of your life fighting the system, being broken by it, suffering more pain, coming back into prison again and again, or you have a chance to do something different with your life. And he really pounces on this in a way that you'd never expect a psychopath to do, because I think part of psychopathy is it doesn't change. It's chronic. It never goes away.
Right,
we know that some of the sort of more antisocial things burn out, but to develop empathy and to develop a sort of curiosity about yourself so late in life was really quite unique for Eddie. And I think he may be the exception, but I think he gives me the sense that there might be hope for all psychopaths if we can just find the right way, the right time to approach them about maybe changing their lives. So it was really, I mean, it was an absolute pleasure to work with the guy. He really is, I think he's become charming in a sort of an authentic way, not in a psychopathic way that you could, you know, we used to sit and sort of eat Danish pastries and drink coffee in his house in East London. And he had two little poodles that sort of ran around our legs, yapping at us and sort of licking us. And then we'd have to go outside for him to have a smoke and things like that. It was a really sort of enriching experience for me to work with someone like that. And sort of the other funny thing was at the same time, one of his relatives was still obviously involved in criminal activity to quite some degree. So we occasionally get these phone calls of them being intercepted by the police, and he'd have to sort of give legal advice and tell them not to pay the drug dealer or pay the drug dealer or whatever it was they were doing at the same time. So the criminal world was sort of still there trying to get in.
Yes.
But he was very good at holding that boundary. You know, this is a space that we're not criminal here. You may be criminal out there, and I'm going to tell you how to deal with that, but we're not criminal here, so don't bring it to my doorstep. And that was just sort of, that for me, that really showed that he learned the lessons of his life, I think.
You write that this is an example of the field making that first bold offer. And you talk about what that kind of treatment might look like in if you had your way. So tell us about what you think your vision is for some of that treatment, what that would include. And that approach.
Well, one of the things about Eddie that was really great was towards the end of his life, he was increasingly becoming involved with treating other offenders. He was working as a facilitator for what we call a mentalization based therapy group. So this would involve him taking the lead in just working through the mentalization process with other offenders. Mentalization is a fairly new concept in the UK. It's 20 years old, but you know these concepts take a while to be developed. It's developed by Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy, who are psychoanalysts at two of the bigger universities in the UK. And essentially, it targets what the core element of psychopathy is, which is the inability to recognize and deal with emotions. The only difference, I guess, between psychopathic realization of mentalization is that this mentalization is about both yourself and other people. So it's about realizing, recognizing, and dealing with mental states that you may have at the same time as recognizing, dealing with them in other people. And I think one of the, you know, the really sort of striking things about working with people with personality disorder and psychopathy is that their ability to recognize emotional states, and certainly in other people, is so limited that it's almost, I remember, I'm not sure if this is relevant, but it's always struck me as the same idea. When I was working in the prison, we had a offender who was probably in his mid-40s, and he kept ringing his cell door bell, and the officers would come. Very often, he just wanted someone to talk to. And that's not what the cell door bell is about. It's about if there's an emergency, ring the bell and somebody will come to you. And this is quite an enlightened prison wing, because we had lots of psychologists and we were trying to help the prison officers to work in a sort of an engaging and psychological way. But one of the prison officers in particular got quite irritated. And I think on the fifth bell of the night, he opened the door and said, "Has anyone ever told you the story of Peter and the Wolf?" And he said, "No. What's that?"
Yeah.
And of course, Peter and the Wolf is something that we all learn when we're sort of 5-6 years old in the UK, and probably in the USA as well. It says if you keep asking for help when you don't need it, when you actually do need help and you ask for help, nobody's going to listen to you. And the fact that this man had never, in 47 years of life, ever heard this story, nobody had ever taken the time to explain it. Sort of, it's interesting sort of fuel to my idea that sometimes psychopathy is actually learned rather than simply handed down. And sometimes there's a way back from that as well. So I think the learning point for me is that the best people to teach psychopaths to live a better life, to manage themselves better, to learn how to process emotions are other psychopaths who somehow made it through this journey. And that's true in a lot of cases in prison. I think, why should you listen to me? In the UK, I'm somebody from probably a different class background. I'm very middle class, or that's the way I'd be seen in the UK. I have a very privileged education. I probably have virtually no touching points from my childhood to most of the men that I work with. I have what I think is a lot of knowledge about these disorders, but that doesn't necessarily give me the sort of epistemic privilege to say this is what you should do to make your life better. Whereas if it comes from somebody who is like you, who has the same experiences, who's been to prison as a prisoner rather than as a psychologist, who's, you know, suffered at the hands of the system and fought it at the same time as well, that's going to come across as much more authentic, I think. And so places in the UK like Grendon Prison, which is a therapeutic community where the treatment is non-hierarchical, it's driven jointly by prisoners and staff, I think is much more promising. The reason I don't immediately recommend Grendon for other prisons is because they have a policy of not taking high-scoring psychopaths. So a lot of the men that I work with wouldn't have been eligible for it. But I think that might be something that could be looked at again. And I also would like to see mentalization-based therapy have a much bigger base, particularly in prison and forensic services in the UK, and maybe start to make the jump into the USA as well. I think it's a very interesting idea. Another great thing about it is it's mostly open source. So if you're interested in mentalization, you can actually Google it and download the training package. It's a pretty hefty slide pack, but at the end of it, you get a pretty good idea about what it is and how to tell the difference between what we call pseudo-mentalizing, where somebody seems to be getting the idea about calling emotions of other people, but is doing it from the wrong standpoint, doing it from maybe an intellectual standpoint, therefore making the wrong call. So there's lots of really interesting resources about it on the web as well. And I'd really like to see that have more of a standing, I think, as a treatment for psychopathy.
You write in the end of your book, the reasons that someone commits a serious crime are unique, complex, and difficult to unearth. And that's why the best crime thrillers are almost always like archaeologies of the perpetrator's mind, peeling back layers of experience and emotion that only make sense in relationship to each other. And this is what makes a psychopath truly not a diagnosis made by a test. Can you comment on that?
So most of my work, my research work is not on psychopathy, it's on violence prevention. As part of that, what I've been trying to do is sort of build up causal relation, the understanding what causes a crime to happen. What are the specific triggers that people have? What are their upbringings? What are the dynamic risk factors? So whether they use drugs, whether they have previous experience of violence, poor relationship. Psychopathy is not really that good a causal risk factor for violence. It doesn't explain why people are violent. So what I'm sort of trying to say there is that, first of all, we can't really think psychopathy doesn't explain why people are horrible to other people. You have, first of all, I guess the example of James Fallon, who, you know, you have to see the brain scan, but this guy has an identical brain scan to that of a psychopath. They're exposed to a very disturbing stimulus, usually something like a baby crying, and he shows absolutely no emotional response whatsoever. And yet he has children who would have been babies themselves. And yet he has a stable relationship, stable, loving relationship with his wife. And he does have other people around to dinner. He may hate their guts for it, but hey, they come around and they drink his wine and eat his meatloaf and things like that. So why is he so different to a psychopath in prison who scores highly on the PCLR and may even have, you know, regrets or concerns, some regrets, some concerns? So I'm against this idea of psychopathy becoming a sort of a way of explaining why crime happens and trying to push people to think a little bit more imaginatively and not just, you know, people who are interested in true crime, but particularly people who write about crime, people who write criminal characters, to think that just psychopathy it's not the end of the explanation. It's a factor, sure. And it's a factor about how people reason emotionally and explain themselves. But if you want to understand why people are murderers, serial killers, rapists, commit terrible crimes, you need to go into more detail in their backgrounds. You need to start that archaeological process of thinking, what does this crime represent for that person? And the idea comes from psychoanalysis, sure, but I don't think it needs to be wrapped up in psychoanalytic terms to still make sense or be a worthwhile journey.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mark Freestone, for coming on and talking about your incredible Making a Psychopath, My Journey into 7 Dangerous Minds. It's been a fascinating interview.
My absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Freestone. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. You too.
Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.